It's so great to be back. I've been thinking a lot about the difference between niceness and kindness these days. So I've been doing a little bit of research. As you know, being a Sutta hound, I always tend to kind of look to what the historical Buddha actually said. I started to write this talk, and then I was looking through the Pali Canon, and interestingly, in the indexes of all of Bhikkhu Bodhi's translations of the suttas, kindness is not actually listed as a word anywhere in the index, which I actually found very fascinating, and I really had to think about that. Buddhist teachers in the West are very big on kindness, you know. But actually, for the historical Buddha, it was loving kindness or metta or Maitreya. And that is not the same, actually, as kindness. And then that got me thinking about how the teachings around kindness, loving kindness, compassion have been extended into the Mahayana, into the Vajrayana, through the teachings on bodhicitta, on the bodhisattva practices, teachings that are extremely profound by amazing people like Shantideva and others. As I was looking through the Pali Canon, I found a sutta which maybe has been taught here before. You know, I always say this. I say, maybe this has been taught here before because I don't want to be hubristic about this. You have lots of amazing teachers who teach you. So maybe some of you have heard the simile of the saw. This is from the Majjhima Nikaya. It's number 21 for any of you who want to go in and actually read it for yourselves. It is quite long. It has a front story and it has a back story. And then there's the teaching right in the middle of it. So I am leaving out the front story. I'm leaving out the back story. And we're just going to focus on what the Buddha actually said. This is a very challenging sutta, very challenging for modern people because modern people have a tendency to be insistent on the primacy of their self. This particular sutta was challenging for the monks. It's even more challenging for us. I'm actually going to read the sutta and then I will deliver what I'm sure the Buddha would have thought of as minimally instructive teachings, but I will try my best. The simile of the saw, and this is a saw as in cutting. The sutta begins, and the Buddha says, a monk, you can translate a monk as practitioner. When you hear monk, you can hear practitioner for us. The Buddha says, a monk may be ever so gentle, ever so mild-tempered, ever so calm, as long as the monk is not touched by disagreeable aspects of speech. But it is only when disagreeable aspects of speech touch the monk, then he can truly be known as gentle, mild-tempered, and calm. There are these five aspects of speech by which others may address you: timely or untimely, true or false, affectionate or harsh, beneficial or unbeneficial, with a mind of goodwill or with a mind of internal hate. The Buddha continues, when you, O monks, are in the midst of unwholesome speech, you should train yourselves in the following way. Our minds will be unaffected and we will say no evil words. We will remain sympathetic to that person's welfare with a mind of goodwill and with no inner hate. We will keep pervading that person with an awareness imbued with goodwill. And beginning with that person, we will keep pervading the all-encompassing world with an awareness imbued with goodwill, abundant, enlarged, immeasurable, free from hostility, free from ill will. Well, I don't know about you, but that sounds like a pretty tall order, right? Well, obviously, the Buddha thought so too. So in his inimitable way, he continues by offering some examples so that the monks can actually have a sense of how to apply this. And he does this in a very interesting way in this particular sutta. He basically goes right for the way in which humans mistake the intentions of others. Here's the first example. The Buddha says, suppose a person comes along carrying a hoe and a basket, saying, I will make this great earth be without earth. And then the person digs here and there and scatters the soil here and there. What do you think, monks? Would this person actually make the great earth be without earth? And then all the monks together, they said, no. And the Buddha says, well, why is that? And then he answers the question. Because this great earth is deep and enormous. It can't easily be made to be without earth. That person would reap only a share of weariness and disappointment. When I read this, I thought, this is why the Buddha was an amazing, amazing psychotherapist. He just goes right for the way a human mind mistakes the actuality of what a person can actually do. And in this case, he's saying, well, they can say they're going to come along and they're going to make the earth without earth, but basically it's impossible because the earth is just so huge. There's no way they can do that. And their own ignorance, their own inability to know their bounds, their own hubris, the sense in which they're mistaking what a human can actually do, makes it so that the scattering of earth, the digging, even though it might be distressful for a monk to experience, in the end, the only thing that person is they're reaping their own exhaustion and disappointment because there's no way they can accomplish this silly thing they say they're going to do. Okay, so the Buddha gives another example. Suppose a person came along with paint saying, I will draw pictures in space. And then he asks the monks, okay, now what do you think? Would this person actually be able to draw pictures in space? And the monks think about it and they all say, no. And the Buddha says, why is that? And then he answers his own question. Because space is formless and without surface. It's not possible to draw pictures in space. So that person would reap only their share of weariness and disappointment. So again, you can see he's using these examples where the harm that a person says they're going to do is not possible actually to do. But because the person's mind is so lost and confused, they aren't even aware that what they're trying to accomplish cannot be accomplished. And therefore, the only harm that they actually cause is their own exhaustion and disappointment. So the Buddha gives another example. Suppose a person came along carrying a torch saying, I'm going to heat up the river Ganges and make it boil. And the Buddha asks the monks, now what do you think? Would this person actually be able to heat up the river Ganges and make it boil? And of course, the monks immediately say, no. And the Buddha says, why is that? And the monks say, because the river Ganges is deep and enormous. It's not easy to heat it up and make it boil. So that person would reap only a share of weariness and disappointment. Similar to the last two examples, right? What they think they can do cannot be accomplished. Remember, you have to have a mind that's capable of recognizing what's true, that that's not accomplishable, in order to not get your knickers in a snit about this thing. If you are not in the wisdom of that can't be done, you could become very upset by someone saying they're going to do that after all. So then the Buddha decides he's really going to bring the point home. And this is where he goes back to the instruction that he gave earlier. He's saying, people can speak to you in all these different ways. Some of the ways will be disagreeable and some of the ways will be agreeable. And if people are speaking to you in an agreeable way, well, he basically says it's really easy to be gentle and mild-tempered and calm. And he's also saying, by the way, that is not actually the test of a practitioner, because the test of a practitioner is, what are you going to bring to the table when somebody is disagreeable? And so his instruction, of course, was long, but essentially what he said, no matter how disagreeable the speech is that's delivered to you, as a practitioner, you have the capacity to remain pervading in an awareness that is so imbued with goodwill and with this immeasurable wisdom that basically no internal hatred would arise in a practitioner. That's a big ask. So the last example is an example which drives home the big ask. So here we go. And this is what I love about this sutta, is teachers of Vajrayana Buddhism down through the history of the Vajrayana will often use examples just like this. And you think to yourself, how can I even aspire to this? This is a great sutta. It's an example of where this originally came from. It originally came from the historical Buddha. So here we go. The big ask. The Buddha says, even if bandits were to carve you up savagely, limb by limb, with a two-handled saw, any one of you that would let their heart get angered would not be doing my bidding. Even then, you should train yourselves in the following way. Our minds will be unaffected, and we will say no evil words. We will remain compassionate with a mind of goodwill, with no inner hate. We will keep pervading these people with an awareness imbued with goodwill. And beginning with them, we will keep pervading the all-encompassing world with an awareness imbued with goodwill, abundant, enlarged, immeasurable, free from hostility, free from ill will. That's how you should train yourself. If you attend constantly to this admonition on the simile of the saw, do you see any aspects of speech, slight or gross, that you could not endure? And the monks really took a moment, I'm sure, to think about it. And they said, no, blessed one. And then the Buddha concluded with this. Then attend constantly to this admonition on the simile of the saw. That will be for your long-term welfare and happiness. So maybe you can imagine why, after I finished reading this particular sutta, I thought, okay, this is daring. How do I teach on such a big ask? You're being sawed limb by limb. And in that sawing, in that act of breaking apart your body, ending your life, even in that, the Buddha is saying, as a practitioner, your heart will not be angered. You will remain unaffected and not have evil thoughts or speak evil words toward those who are doing the sawing. You will remain compassionate and the mind clear with goodwill, keeping one thing in mind, which is, awareness is immeasurable, and the nature of who you actually are in that moment when your body is being sawed is pure awareness, the basic space of emptiness and the lucidity of mind, which cannot be touched, which is beyond being sought. And the compassionate aspect of this is the clarity and the willingness to recognize the dreamlike nature of all phenomena, meaning all phenomena is inseparable and empty of any separate self-existence or solidity. If that is what you have in your mind, it is entirely possible to have the mind filled with the bodhicitta, total, complete recognition of human suffering and the nature of human suffering, and to wish the two people on either end of that two-handled saw freedom from their suffering while they are cutting you apart and ending your life. Wow. So I thought to myself, well, now what do I say to them? How does one accomplish the depth of understanding such virtuous conduct requires? It's really a big ask by the Buddha. There's two ways to go about this. There's a shorthand and there's a longhand way. The shorthand actually is a very short paragraph from another sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. It's number 140, and it's a very small part of it, where the Buddha actually talks about what he calls the four determinations. So a determination is something that a practitioner determines to practice. It's like a commitment. And the four determinations are as follows. One, a practitioner should not be negligent of discernment. That's the clarity of mind, the wisdom to know what is true. Number two, a practitioner should guard the truth. And this is very important. Once one has the discernment of what's true, there's a certain vigilance that the Buddha is asking practitioners to have around guarding the preciousness of that knowing, not to be swayed, not to be lost in doubt, to stay with the discernment of what is true. Number three, be devoted to relinquishment. This one is so important, particularly when you got those two people sawing you in limb by limb, right? There's a certain quality of relinquishing. One is relinquishing the ego fixation around my life is so important. I must generate anger that my life is being ended. When we relinquish the importance of our existence in that self-special way, which is the bodhisattvic vow. And by the way, the Buddha was a bodhisattva for thousands of lifetimes before the lifetime when he actually managed to attain Buddhahood and enlightenment. So even though in the Theravada, the bodhisattvic path is not taught as much as it is the Mahayana path, it's a big part of it. And the Vajrayana path, it's a big part of it. These teachings are a big part of the way the Theravada was taught in terms of who the Buddha was and how come he was able to attain enlightenment. Relinquishment is a huge part of being a bodhisattva. One is continually relinquishing their own self-serving nature to the benefit of the awakening of all other beings. One is continually committing oneself. Everything one does in this existence is for the benefit of the awakening of all beings. And of course, all beings includes oneself. And then number four is, and train only for calm. I mean, try to imagine what it must take to have a mind that is tranquil in the midst of such disturbance as being sawed limb by limb. It's almost impossible to imagine, at least for me. I don't know, maybe some of you can imagine it. It's just that kind of tranquility that arises from the direct recognition of the immeasurable quality of pure awareness, of the basic space of emptiness, lucidity of awareness, those two things together. It is that direct experience that must be the ground from which such tranquility of mind arises. So when you put the four determinations together, what you get a recipe for clarity, wisdom, and skillful action. Be discerning. Guard what you know is true. Relinquish self-fixation and train for tranquility in the midst of disturbance. So that's the short recipe. The longer recipe would be, I think, prescribed by the Buddha in three fundamental internal commitments which can be practiced. So obviously the first fundamental commitment is to right view or wise view. And as many of you know, this is the first of the Eightfold Noble Path. Difficult first because honestly, it's the whole ball of wax. So to put it first, the Buddha, I guess, had the intention to show you where you were going ultimately and to tell you you need to understand this to go anywhere on the Buddhist path. So right view includes the recognition of impermanence. All phenomena is of the nature to arise, exist, and pass away. There is no permanence whatsoever in any internal or external phenomena. Unsatisfactoriness, meaning all phenomena that arises internally or externally, has the nature of unsatisfactoriness in that it is impermanent. Nothing stays. So the inherent unsatisfactoriness is phenomena comes and goes. And then the third, of course, is not self, which is that relinquishment of self-fixation and the entire frame that the self is something that requires us to view it as separate from all other beings, from all other phenomena, this real solid thing inside of us, which we think is unchanging and we think is perfectly satisfactory, but of course is not, because it's like everything else. It is continually changing. It has the quality of unsatisfactoriness, and of course it is not separate and solid. And then the second fundamental internal commitment is to right intention. And for me, this is a commitment that the Buddha makes really clear in the simile of the saw. It's a commitment to thoughts, affect, and actions that are imbued with equanimity. And that equanimity arises from the skillful application of the 10 paramis. And these are the 10 character traits of enlightened beings. Now, interestingly, you know, the Buddha was very famous for lists, but there's nowhere in the Pali Canon, actually, where the Buddha lists the 10 paramis in a list as, here are the 10 paramis, you need to practice these. It's interesting that he doesn't do that because there are so many suttas in which he talks about the 10 paramis, even though he doesn't give them as a definitive list of, here's the qualities you need in order to be an enlightened being. I mean, years ago, I remember Philip teaching on the paramis quite a bit. And I know that some of you have heard teachings on the paramis, but some of you may not have. If you are practicing these 10 paramis, you might actually be able to accomplish the kind of mind the Buddha is asking us to have in the simile of the saw. So I will just go through the list because tonight I don't have that much time, but I think I'm going to next week talk more about the difference between niceness and kindness, and the paramis will come up quite a bit. in that particular talk. The first one is generosity. I mean, I would have to say, if you're being sawed limb to limb and your mind is imbued with wisdom and compassion, that is the most generous thing you can possibly do for the person who is in the act of killing you, which is to not generate ill will and hatred toward them. That, to me, is the ultimate act of generosity. Because what you're doing is you're modeling something you would want them to have. And you might even think, you know, my last act on earth before I'm dead is to embody wisdom and compassion. And I might actually awaken a person who's sawing me up limb to limb. I might actually do that. That might be the last thing I do. And that would be very bodhisattvic. And of course, the second parami is virtue. And everything we've been talking about tonight is virtuous. We've already named the quality of renunciation earlier in the four determinations. Renunciation is a big part of what the Buddha is talking about in the simile of the saw. Wisdom goes without saying. Energy. Virya is very important when it comes to the paramis. And I think even though the Buddha didn't use the word zeal or energy, he's actually asking the monks to bring a certain quality of zeal to recognizing what's true. Seeing that a person who says they can boil the Ganges is just lost, and to regard them as a human who's suffering and not hate them for that, and not get lost in my own suffering about the fact that they're confused and lost. Patience is the next parami. Someone who comes to you and says they're going to rid the earth of earth itself, one needs to be patient with them because they're very confused. Truthfulness goes without saying. Determination, goodwill, and equanimity. These are the 10 paramis. And you can see that they are critically important for even beginning to imagine how a practitioner might even start to come close to enacting this wisdom that the Buddha is asking of us. So I know that was a lot. I think I might stop here so that I can open this up, answer some questions, or even hear some reflections, because this is a very challenging sutra. So I thought maybe some of you might want to unmute. Yeah, go for it.
Lisa, I just want to back up from in the beginning. You talked about, with right speech, things to consider. And I wonder if I could ask you to review that list.
As you know, the Buddha had teachings on wise speech. And they actually were very simple. When you engage in wise speech, you want it to be, firstly, timely. You want it to be kind. You want it to be beneficial. And you want to make sure that you are speaking truth. So those are the four qualities of wise speech. It should be true. It should definitely be timely. It should be kind, and it should be beneficial. In the beginning of the sutta, he said that there are five ways in which people can address you, and those ways were timely or untimely, true or false, affectionate or harsh, beneficial or unbeneficial, with a mind of goodwill or with a mind of inner hate. Anyone else?
Thank you for bringing up the paramis, and I just wanted to mention for anyone who's interested in further reading it, is Ajahn Suchito has a wonderful book, Paramis, Crossing Life's Floods, and it is available online. If you Google it, you can just download it for free. And I cannot tell you, I sent this book to lots of people. It is a wonderful, wonderful book to read and to go back and look at again. So
I second the motion. Yes, excellent book.
I love this talk, thank you. When I hear the parable of the saw, which I have heard before, it is a big ask and I can't wrap my mind around it. However, it comes to mind sometimes when I'm in the middle of a difficult conversation and I'm about to burst out with my anger and bad reaction. I tell myself, at least you're not being sawed limb by limb. And it puts it in perspective. So I can't quite get to where the Buddha's telling us to go, but I can think about the person in that story and think, things could be worse. Just hold your words here.
I love that. You kind of are there, okay?
Huh.
And I'm saying that because there is a certain kind of discernment. So remember that list of determinations. You've discerned the nature of the experience you're having, and you're guarding a certain kind of truth, something that's true for you. And you're willing to relinquish the ego fixation in the moment, and then you are training for tranquility. So I would say you, in fact, are practicing the four determinations. What would you say?
I would say you give a lot of credit, because even though my mind goes there, I don't always act accordingly, but my mind is telling me how to act, even though I don't always follow through with the perfect right speech in the moment.
So there is no such thing as perfect anything. Because we are human. That is the saving grace in all of this, I would definitely say. You know, parami means perfection. So what is being perfected in those 10 qualities, or if you are over in the Mahayana and the Vajrayana, it's only 6 of them. If you are training in the paramis, you are training in the perfection of awareness, because awareness is the ultimate refuge, you see. In awareness is the equanimity. And it's just that we fall out of awareness into ego fixation so readily and so easily without recognizing it that we get lost. This is why, you know, my teacher Mindy Rinpoche, my teacher Ajahn Sumedho, my teacher Dzogchen Rinpoche, all three of them, you know, most of what they tell us as students is don't get lost. And what they mean is don't lose awareness. You're in awareness. The question is whether or not you can allow yourself to recognize, to discern the truth of ego fixation. And ultimately, that's what the simile of the saw is about. Who are you really? Recognize your nature, your true nature, which is the inseparability of awareness and emptiness, lucidity of mind, and the empty nature of all phenomena. That is who we really are, and nothing else. And that can't be sawed. That is beyond being sawed. And this is the teaching, the ultimate teaching of the Buddha.
I just want to thank you for this talk. I've always sort of enjoyed this parable, the simile, in kind of a perverse way. Like, oh God, look at how extreme this is. But you really unpacked it and looked at why we really need to approach it and what it means to hold this as some kind of weird ideal, you know, and really move toward it. And I think that was a wonderful job, so thank you.
Well, I'm just curious, prior to this talk, what have you been taught about this sutta? I mean, how have other teachers approached this with you?
I haven't been taught that much by other teachers. I've read it a lot, and I don't remember exactly. I've always just had this feeling, well, it really raises the bar on love your enemy.
Well, I appreciate that very much. Okay. Well, this was such a joy, and we shall continue next week. I look forward to it.